The American History Podcast, Season 2, Episode 27, The Battle of Buena Vista, Part 1.
Welcome to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Worswick.
All right, welcome back. Before we get started, let me remind you that you can go to www.theamericanhistorypodcast.com and sign up for our email list. If you're into the whole social media thing, I'm on Twitter, at AmericanHisCast. Also, if you would like to support the show, you can head over to Patreon, and for $3 a month, you'll get access to our special Patreon members-only series titled 1983, the year the world almost ended. If you go to the website, there is a button down at the bottom of the main page. You can click on that, and that'll take you directly to the Patreon page. And finally, if you haven't noticed, the sound has improved big time. Again, that's thanks to this new microphone that I'm using, but also, mostly, due to my sound editor. He suggested a new mic, which works with my iPhone, and the results have been amazing. So I had been using a very nice microphone in the past and GarageBand, but for some reason GarageBand apparently did not like me. But anyways, if you need some sound editing, you can reach him at madoctomedia@gmail.com, and his website is madoctopusmedia.com. Okay, so enough of that. This episode represents kind of a transition from the first half of the war to the second half of the war. I'm really excited to get on with it, so let's get started. First, however, is the Song of the Week. And this week, the Song of the Week is Old Folks at Home by Stephen Foster. Enjoy, and we'll see you on the other side. Back in episode 24 of this season, we mentioned the return of Santa Anna. So let's pick up there. Now, if you remember, he came back into power posing as a Federalist. Of course, at the end of the day, he was simply an opportunist who was more than willing to take advantage of any chance that he had to advance his own cause. But let's talk about Federalism in Mexico. As historian Peter Guardino notes in The Dead March, a book that we've referenced numerous times, this season, Mexican federalism emphasized not only decentralizing power, but also the extension of citizenship to even the poorest of Mexicans. Further, it extolled the ideal of the citizen soldier and expressed this through the recruiting of new regiments of the National Guard. Now, you should be aware of the fact that this ideal wasn't a new one. In fact, Mexico had a strong militia tradition that dated back to colonial times. The purpose of this militia was not to go out on campaign, but it was to remain at home and defend the local area. Now, the problem with this system was that in the rough and tumble climate of Mexican politics, the political loyalties of these groups often varied, and they tended to take part in civil wars and coups. So when the centralist regime took control in 1835, they actually started to de-emphasize the militia and instead focused precious resources on the regular army. Then, in 1845, as war over Texas started to become a very real possibility, there was an attempt to create a new militia system. Now, as the Federalists came back into power, their first goal was to revive the militia system. And along these lines, in September 1846, they established a National Guard. Similar to their American counterparts in many ways, they were organized on a local level, recruited from different villages and neighborhoods and occupational groups. These units were then organized into regiments named either for the city or the state in which they were created. So one example of this is from Mexico City itself, which contained a battalion made up of employees from a cigar factory. Another battalion was formed of men who worked in commerce. And one of the problems was the presence of intense local pride. So sometimes units would explicitly ask that they not be grouped with companies from another district or another town, and thus rivalries could be a problem. Similarly to their American counterparts, many of these units' loyalties were to the state or province, and their pride could be often displayed through the use of unit flags. Now, these flags often were made by women of the local area, and they were presented to the units in fairly elaborate ceremonies. And these National Guardsmen were, at the end of the day, the ultimate expression of the idea of the citizen soldier. They took up arms because they were respectable citizens. The nation, according to this ideology, was a representation of the will of the citizen. These National Guardsmen were, at the end of the day, the ultimate expression of the idea of the citizen soldier. They took up arms because they were respectable citizens. The nation, according to this ideology, was a representation of the will of the citizen. And thus it was their duty to defend the nation. The decree that established the National Guard specifically stated that the institution was inherent to democratic governance, and it insisted that National Guard officers conduct themselves as citizens who commanded other citizens. Now, before we move on, one more point about these National Guard units. Because they were often organized around a specific local group, they tended to exhibit a distinct political leaning. In this way, they were also similar to their American counterparts. But in the United States, between 1783 and the outbreak of the War for Southern Independence, the citizen soldier did not employ force in internal politics. In Mexico, on the other hand, they became crucial to the internal politics of the era. Thus, these units were more than a simple tool designed to repel the American invasion. Further, because units tended to have a political leaning, for example, those raised in the states of Guerrero and Morelos had an affinity towards radical federalism, the rank-and-file soldiers were building visions of what the nation-state should be. Now, in the meantime, Santa Anna had returned to power, but he was no fool. He was aware of the fact that the lavish ceremonies or celebrations upon his return were organized by his followers. They masked the prevailing disorder and discontent with the status quo that plagued the country. The one thing that united Mexicans in 1846 was their hostility towards the American invaders, and, being aware of this, the dictator decided to exploit it for his own purposes. He placed the administration of the government in the hands of General José Mariano Salas, and resumed his position as the country's military defender. He then organized the units around the capital into a new army and made preparations to move north. On September 28, he led his small army out of the capital and headed north to San Luis Potosi, which he would use as his base of operations against General Taylor. I should mention here that Santa Anna's position overall was, to put it one way, complicated. He had been allowed to return to Mexico by the Americans, largely because he tricked them into believing that he would negotiate a quick end to the war. Understanding the terrain better than the Americans, the dictator was aware that to go from Monterrey to Saltillo, and eventually San Luis Potosi, the next towns on the road south, meant that the U.S. Army would have to traverse a desert if they were to get to that goal. Shrewdly, Santa Anna had suggested to Polk that the key to Mexico was the latter of the two towns. Thus, he hoped the Americans would move south and give him the opportunity to defend a fortified city, which is what it was, against a weakened U.S. Army, one that had overextended supply lines and had just traversed a desert. In early October, Santa Anna arrived at San Luis Potosi, determined to train and equip an invincible army to attack and destroy Taylor. It should be noted that the American supply line was becoming longer and more vulnerable to attack with every mile it ventured further into Mexican territory. Now, while the idea was sound, it was in the implementation where this whole thing is going to fall apart. The problem was that Santa Anna recalled all garrisons in the towns and villages in Mexico, thus giving Taylor and the Americans a free hand in the north. To say this was met with opposition is a bit of an understatement. In Tampico, a port city in the Gulf of Mexico, the citizens complained of complicity with the Americans. However, these accusations were a price the so-called Napoleon of the West was willing to pay, as long as the outcome gave him the great army that he imagined. And this was not the only problem he faced. One major problem was obtaining logistical support. At first, when the threat from the Americans caused an initial fear, Mexican citizens came forth with resources. However, once the initial scare passed, as it inevitably did, the attitude reverted to normal. That is to say, apathy. Obtaining not only supplies but recruits was difficult. Remember, Santa Anna had all but conceded the northern territories to the U.S. Army. And by fall of this year, New Mexico and California were also cut off from the rest of the nation. The state of Durango said it could not afford to send troops, as it had troubles with the Indians. So too did Michoacán. To make matters worse, the state of Zacatecas was plotting with others to overthrow the new regime. Some did cooperate. Guanajuato, I hope I said that right, sent 5,000 men, while Jalisco sent 2,000. Then there was the problem of funding, a perpetual problem. An army of 35,000 soldiers, which was the plan, would eat up approximately 1 million pesos per month. Funding this army would be difficult at best, as the usual sources of funds, customs duties, in this case, had dried up thanks to a naval blockade imposed on the country by the U.S. Navy. So new sources of funding would have to be found. Santa Anna then pressed the Catholic Church to assist the government, which they reluctantly did. In the end, he was able to secure a loan for 15 million pesos using church property as collateral. As this was happening, the political situation in the capital was becoming more balkanized than ever. The acting president was mostly bypassed, and both the Puros, those who had ousted Paredes, and the Moderatos looked north to San Luis Potosí for guidance. His ability to play one faction off the other meant Santa Anna was in the driver's seat, at least for the time being. But remember, plots were commonplace in the capital city and throughout the country. We've already seen a few states had begun planning the demise of the Napoleon of the West, so his position was not as secure as he might have wished. In early December 1846, the Senate held a presidential election, which Santa Anna won, but just barely. In the end, he won 11-9. Valentin Gomez Farias was elected vice president, the irony being that he had been president in the past, succeeding Santa Anna, and then being succeeded by, you guessed it, Santa Anna. Even more ironic is the fact that Farias had enacted liberal reforms that were meant to weaken both the Catholic Church and the military in Mexico. In the end, he was able to take over the daily governance from Salas and bring some modicum of stability to this situation, although he was a poor fundraiser. Luckily for Santa Anna, the governor of San Luis Potosí pledged local resources to the army. Now in the end, his 4 months at San Luis Potosí was productive for Santa Anna. While he was not able to raise an army of 35,000 men, he did assemble a force of 3 infantry divisions, 4 separate cavalry brigades, a regiment of hussars, and a division of observation, for a total force of approximately 20,000 men. Now, thanks to an effective training program, this was the strongest force that Mexico would field during the entirety of the war, and by January 1847, it was overwhelmingly superior to the force under General Zachary Taylor. Our friend Guardino notes that the gathering, arming, and equipping of this army was perhaps one of the greatest accomplishments of the 19th century nation-state in Mexico. Having said that, he goes on to caution us against believing this nation-state was a centralized state. Remember, the Federalists had just taken control once again, so most, if not all, of these men were recruited by local governments. Almost all of the churches in the town of San Luis Potosí were turned into barracks for the troops. Local blacksmiths and carpenters made or repaired broken weapons, while an office was established to take in donations of corn, beans, firewood, lead, copper, and even money to help support the army. A committee of prominent women oversaw the hospital where many of the troops from Monterrey were recovering. Now, speaking of Taylor, he was stuck at Monterrey, largely immobilized by the terms of a truce he had signed. In large part, he was able to take advantage of a lull in fighting, as his force did need some time to recover from the Battle of Monterrey. Some of the volunteer soldiers had left for home and needed to be replaced. Originally, Polk's plan called for Taylor to lead the main occupation force and take over all of the northern and northwestern states. In the meantime, Brigadier General John Wool would eventually cross the Rio Grande and fall under Taylor's command. However, his job would be to move 500 miles to the west, seize Chihuahua, while 270 miles south of the port of Tampico would be captured by Commodore David Connor's home squadron. John Wool, whom we just mentioned, was one of those Whig generals that was mistrusted by President Polk. However, Wool was a capable soldier, and he presented no political threat to the president. So Polk met with him on May 28, 1846, and ordered him to head out west, where he would help speedily raise a group of volunteers and march them to the Rio Grande as soon as possible. Without even waiting for written orders, the general headed west for Louisville, which is where he was when his orders finally caught up with him. It turns out Polk had picked just the man for the job. He was a meticulous officer, and this is what was needed for the task given to him. By August 14, he arrived in San Antonio, only to discover the town of 2,000 people was unable to provide the supplies he needed. At this point, he decided to break his force into two groups, one numbering 1,300 and the second 1,200. The plan was now for Wool to move into northern Mexico and then head for Chihuahua. By the end of October, he had reached the town of Monclova in northern Mexico. A small town in a region known for its semi-arid climate, the location was as good a place as any to stop and regroup. Reporting his presence to Taylor, Wool took the time to drill his men and scout the road to Chihuahua while he awaited orders. Taylor, bound by the provisions of his temporary truce, ordered Wool to wait there for further instructions. This was probably for the best, as it not only allowed Wool to train his men in marching, but he was able to instill a bit of military discipline into a group of volunteers, many of whom were rough around the edges, to say the least. By this point, the U.S. Navy was ready to get in on the action in the Gulf of Mexico. The port city of Tampico was a target for occupation, and understandably so, as it was Mexico's second most important city. Tampico was an interesting city. Due to its distance from the capital, it had been a hotbed of revolutionary activity against the central government several times in the past. As war with the United States became inevitable, it was decided by the government to fortify the city and defend it at all costs. However, if you remember, Santa Anna had ordered all forces to San Luis Potosi, leaving the port open to easy occupation. Commodore Connor, in charge of naval forces in the region, felt it would be difficult to take and hold the port without the aid of troops, and let the president know of his ideas. Thus, Polk ordered 3,000 men to be detached from Taylor's forces and sent to aid in the capture of the port. Taylor, who by this point was starting to get a bit touchy, strenuously objected and refused to allow any troops from his command to go and assist the Navy. Thus, Commodore Connor would have to take the city with his own forces. It so happens that, at this point, an American agent in Tampico notified the Navy that all Mexican forces in the town had been recalled. Unaware of the exact situation in the city, Connor waited until mid-November before he made his move. As he moved his ships into the harbor, a deputation from the city came out and met with him, pleading for a peaceful occupation of the town. They argued they were not in any position to resist. Thus, the next morning, Connors formally issued a declaration that the city was now under the protection of the United States. In the meantime, Secretary of War William Marcy sent a letter to General Taylor, ordering him to terminate the armistice of September 25. This letter arrived on November 2nd. Needless to say, Taylor was furious at the rebuke, but did as ordered. He sent a letter to Santa Anna terminating the truce and calculated that said letter should arrive in San Luis Potosi on November 15. Thus he was, at that point, free to resume hostilities. Now just a few words about the overall situation. By November, it had become apparent, the powers that be in Washington, that a quick and easy victory over a submissive Mexico was not going to be. It was perfectly clear that the limited war strategy had failed. The war would have to be carried at least to Mexico's port cities along the Gulf of Mexico, and, most likely, all the way to the capital city itself. This was not something the administration realized suddenly, and it was something they... not something, I should say, that they wanted to acknowledge. Indeed, Polk and his advisors had, for quite some time, considered landing troops at Veracruz, but the need to call up new volunteers for such an operation kept them from making the final decision to do it. Now, what finally decided the issue was the arrival in Washington of Polk's favorite military advisor, Senator Thomas Hart Benton. He took issue with the draft of Polk's upcoming State of the Union message. Benton noted that Polk's policy of masterly inactivity should end, as it ran counter to his nature. Benton advocated an expedition be mounted to seize Veracruz, followed up by a powerful expeditionary force to move inland and seize Mexico City itself. And, of course, Benton argued that a bipartisan commission of distinguished political leaders, one which would include himself, ought to accompany that force to negotiate the peace. These ideas were presented to Polk, by Polk to his cabinet on November 10. The problem was the idea of calling up more volunteers and widening the war was not a popular one, even inside the cabinet. Secretary of War Marcy himself was on public record as being against this idea. Polk had Benton attend the next cabinet meeting, where he could argue for the more aggressive policy, and Benton was able to win the reluctant support of most of the cabinet. As a sort of concession to Marcy, Polk agreed to call up only 9 new regiments rather than the 10 recommended by Benton. Now the argument moved to who should be in charge of this expedition. By this time, fall of 1846, Taylor was out of favor with Polk, so he was ruled out. Benton argued for himself as commander. He felt there should be a lieutenant general of the army who would be given the title general-in-chief. In his mind, this person should be a man of talent and resources. He said that if Congress created such an office, he would be willing to accept the command himself, of course. This surprised Polk not at all, as Benton had once been considered by President Jackson as a possible general-in-chief, and the idea of a Democrat as general-in-chief was one that pleased Polk. In the meantime, Scott continued to languish in Washington. The general, however, was no fool. Instead of engaging in public outbursts, he took on the role of team player. He was sure to show the proper deference to Marcy and wisely removed his command to West Point, which put some distance between himself and both Polk and Marcy in the capital. By September, Taylor began to fall out of favor thanks to his ill-advised truce in Monterrey. Thus, by early November, Marcy was now convinced that Scott was the most capable commander they had available to lead the expedition to Veracruz and eventually to Mexico City itself. On Wednesday, November 18, 1846, Marcy formally recommended Scott to Polk, arguing that the former had rendered himself politically harmless. The president, still not quite convinced, invited Benton back to the White House to discuss the matter. At this point, it was clear Congress was in no hurry to establish the position of lieutenant general anytime soon, so Benton seconded Marcy's choice of Scott. Polk finally gave in. Although, I should note, Polk told Benton that if Congress were finally to create the position of lieutenant general or the position of general in charge of the entire U.S. Army, those positions would go to Benton. The next day, Polk sent for Scott. The old general was, however, made to suffer a bit under the president. First, Polk discussed the expedition to Veracruz at length, noting the importance of the campaign, and then finally saying that if he could be satisfied of the general's, quote, proper confidence in the administration, end quote, he, Polk, was ready to assign the command to him. Scott, needless to say, was much affected and says basically that, yes, the administration does have his utmost confidence. Scott was definitely grateful for the command, and he left the president's office almost in tears. Polk, for his part, still hoped to replace Scott at some future point with Lieutenant General Thomas Hart Benton. Now, in Washington, the politicians and General Scott had just changed the character of the war. However, General Taylor wasn't aware of this and still believed that in his earlier strategy. Rather than attempt to capture the capital city, American forces should instead focus on cutting off the northern provinces. However, he now believed that in order to take the northern regions, he would need approximately 30,000 troops, at least half of whom should be regulars. There was one change in his thinking. If this did not accomplish the goal of getting Mexico to surrender, then an amphibious landing near Veracruz, along with a subsequent assault of the capital itself, was probably going to be needed. This force, in his view, would have to be at least 20,000 strong, again, half of whom would have to be regular troops. I should note that he viewed a campaign to take Mexico City with great reluctance, as he thought he would be the man in charge with its execution. Be that as it may, Taylor was busy attempting to secure his position and to continue his strategy of winning the North. In this vein, on November 8, he moved forward from Monterrey to Saltillo. Having received a message from Washington, which ordered him to secure his position and keep the lines of communication open, Taylor continued as planned. General Worth took 1,000 men, and Taylor followed closely with two separate squadrons of dragoons. A 17-mile march took them to Saltillo, where they discovered the climate had changed from tropical to temperate. They also noted a change in the attitude of the locals. They were now more openly hostile towards the occupying forces. The army easily took the town of Saltillo and found the city fairly agreeable, if the people were, understandably, not. Now, for the Americans, the situation was changing. The threat of a large Mexican army attacking them appeared remote, so Taylor decided to employ the strategy he had used along the frontier: occupy strategic strong points. So he reorganized his forces. He grouped the Ohio and Kentucky infantry regiments into one brigade under the command of General Butler, and the Georgia, Mississippi, and 1st Tennessee regiments into another brigade under the command of General Quitman. There was a problem in that Taylor intended to take the bulk of his forces to Victoria, while Scott, remember, Scott's now coming into the picture. Scott was planning to move south, sent a letter saying he would need many of Taylor's troops for his own army, which would be operating in a new area. What was going on? Well, in their discussions, President Polk had ordered Scott not to inform Taylor of the new strategy, but Scott couldn't help himself. So, while he did not say exactly what was happening, any general worth his weight in sand could have figured it out. 2 days after Christmas, General Winfield Scott arrives in Texas. In the meantime, he can't forget Santa Anna. His spies told him of Taylor's plans to move the bulk of his forces to Victoria. The Mexican general decided to now take up the initiative and attempt to overwhelm Worth's small garrison at Saltillo. So he ordered the bulk of his cavalry north, with the idea that he would follow with his main army as soon as possible. Word of this reached the Americans, and by the 21st of December, most of the American forces in northern Mexico converged on the small town of Saltillo to counter Santa Anna. Of course, Santa Anna heard of this change in the American plans and changed his own plans, which the Americans learned of as well. Are you confused yet? Taylor, frustrated by this, decided to proceed with his original intent of moving on to Victoria, southeast of Saltillo. Now, why is he trying to do this? Well, Taylor's purpose was he was trying to determine if Santa Anna could approach Saltillo from this direction. And Taylor ended up deciding probably not. American forces first occupied that town on December 25th, and by January 4th, Taylor himself had arrived. At this point, he finally receives word of Scott. If you didn't, and maybe I didn't make it clear, but Scott's already arrived in Texas, but Taylor had no idea of what was going on until he actually finds out this message here on January 4th, and informed the general that he would be happy to return to Monterrey, possibly in early February, to meet and discuss their plans further. Now, I don't want to complicate this too much, but the friendship between Taylor and Scott begins to break down, most likely due to faulty communications. Scott had left Texas and was in the region at a town named Camargo. When he received word that Taylor had moved on to Victoria. This was January 3rd, 1847. Taylor's cheerful missive, written December 26th, was waiting, but the word appears to not have mattered much to General Scott. In Taylor's absence, Scott asserted his authority and hastily ordered General Butler to put most of Taylor's troops in motion for the Rio Grande. In the end, he took approximately 9,000 troops, and Taylor was, needless to say, not Scott's biggest fan. By late January, it appeared that all was well at Monterrey, if not for a few bruised egos amongst the generals. Santa Anna had left San Luis Potosi and return to the capital. The Army of Potosí was now suffering from a lack of supplies, thanks to the Mexican Congress being either unwilling or unable to vote the necessary appropriations. However, Santa Anna was again in possession of American plans. Santa Anna was now aware of Scott's plan to land at Veracruz, and both Scott and Taylor believed the Mexican general would react by moving his army, at least in part, to deal with the new threat. Thus, Taylor decided to move south of Saltillo, although not all the way to San Luis Potosí. However, this is a mistake. The Americans were assuming that Santa Anna would react the way they would react. Instead, he was much more worried about elevating his personal position in the eyes of the Mexican public, and he believed the best way to do that was to overwhelm and possibly destroy Taylor's forces. Add to this the fact that political pressure in Mexico City was increasing, as people became increasingly frustrated by the Napoleon of the West's lack of action up to this point, and so Santa Anna decided it was time. He took an army of 20,000 and marched through the desert and the mountains that lay in between San Luis Potosí and Saltillo in an attempt to destroy Taylor. Thus the stage is set for not only the Battle of Buena Vista, but for the second half of the war. And we will discuss the actual Battle of Buena Vista in the next episode. I hope you enjoyed this one. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to email me. You can contact me, Sean, at theamericanhistorypodcast@gmail.com. Or you can contact me through the website. Just go to theamericanhistorypodcast.com, sign up for our email list, and you can find me on Twitter again, like I said at the beginning of the episode, @AmericanHisCast. So, until next time, good day.